But first today, to a shocking and gruesome tale from across the Tasman in 1950s New Zealand. In the winter of 54, two schoolgirls, Pauline Parker and Juliet Hume, brutally murdered Pauline's mother on a remote walking track in the South Island's main city, Christchurch. Peter Jackson's first film, Heavenly Creatures, was about this crime. And there's a seemingly never-ending supply of articles, films and books, all speculating on the motives of the two girls and their relationship. Were they girls gone bad or girls gone mad? Today on Hindsight, producer Ruth Barron travelled back to the crime scene with author Peter Graham. They set out to discover what echoes of the case remain in the buildings, the landscape and the people of Christchurch. And we do need to warn you, the program contains graphic descriptions of the scene of the crime.
What was their plan?
Well, Mrs. Parker had been persuaded to go with the two girls up to Victoria Park, and the original idea was that they were all going to have a picnic together, and it would be a sort of a farewell for Juliet. And clearly Pauline had this very remote track that we're now walking on in mind as a spot to kill her mother. And as we know, it was the middle of winter and it was a bit damp and slushy underfoot. And they had taken, or Juliet had taken, half a brick from her house, put it in a shoulder bag, taken it to Pauline's house. The two girls put the half brick in a stocking, tied a knot around the ankle of the stocking, and this was being carried by Pauline, and this was going to be the murder weapon. They were going to bash Pauline's mother over the head, and I think they hoped that one good blow would kill her.
Just like the movies.
Just like in the movies, and then they would roll her body over the bank and they would hope it looked like an accident, that she'd accidentally fallen and hit her head and died.
I'm standing looking at the gently sloping grass bank of the Avon River in downtown Christchurch, an elegant English colonial city laid out like a green chessboard around its central square and cathedral. In between me and the tree-lined waterway are two sets of very high fences. After more than a year of devastating earthquakes, this is the start of the Red Zone. The spire of that cathedral is no more. And the downtown is more like London after the Blitz than the quaint outpost of the empire that it was. A block or two from here is the broken facade of the old Canterbury College. In the 1950s, the imposing edifice of the local Supreme Court stood right here. And on a chill Monday morning in August in 1954, a large crowd gathered outside its doors, mostly women in tweed skirts, waiting to see two girls enter the court. By the end of the week-long trial, there was a throng awaiting a verdict.
Juliet's part in the early phases of this was to bring with her a little gemstone of some sort that I think had come from a ring or a brooch, and she was to drop this stone on the track and point it out to Pauline's mother, who would then bend down to have a look. And when she was bending down, Pauline would come up behind and give her this almighty whack over the back of the head with the brick in the stocking.
But it was premeditated.
Oh, heavens yes, it was planned, you know, at least a week before.
And why did they want to murder Pauline's mother?
She seemed to the girls to be standing in the way. She wouldn't, or Pauline knew she wouldn't let her go with Juliet and her father to South Africa and thence on to England. They saw it as a solution to a problem.
There are living among two beautiful daughters of a man who possesses two beautiful daughters, the most glorious beings in creation. They'd be the pride and joy of any nation. You cannot know nor try to guess the sweet soothingness of their caress. The outstanding genius of this pair is understood by few, they are so rare. Compared with these two, every man is a fool. The world is honored that they should deign to rule. And above us, these goddesses reign on high. I worship the power of these lovely two with that adoring love known to so few. 'Tis indeed a miracle one must feel that two such heavenly creatures are real.
Where we are now is where there was a tea kiosk. The three of them went in and had... Mrs. Parker had had a cup of tea, and the two girls had soft drinks, and they had buns and things to eat. A quiet little afternoon tea, kindly paid for by Mrs. Parker. The girls, of course, having murder on their minds.
I was facing some traumatic family situations. I was still ill and on medication, which does alter judgment to some extent. And I was jammed into a situation where I felt that the other girl would take her own life. And I just panicked and felt as if I couldn't get out of it. And I owed her a considerable debt for the way she'd stood by me when I was sick and in hospital and not allowed visitors and wrote to me every day. And, you know, it's very difficult to walk away from somebody if you feel that that's a situation. I mean, it was no teenage passion. I'd never even been kissed. I mean, there was nothing sexy about it at all. We were two teenage girls, and going to an all-girls school, who would your friend be but another girl? And that's it. We were friends. We were both ill, so possibly we were closer than had we had a wider circle. And we were intense about everything, as 15-year-olds are.
I'm standing outside the building where Dr. Francis Bennett practiced. It's a white, two-story building made of wood. In December 1953, Pauline's mother brought her here to be examined. Dr. Bennett happened to be a family friend of the Humes, who were worried about Pauline's unhealthy association with Juliet. After an uncooperative meeting with Pauline, Dr. Bennett concluded that Pauline and Juliet suffered from what in the 1950s was a psychiatric illness, homosexual attachment.
Do you think they were lesbians?
I don't think it matters. They were perceived as lesbians. Both the prosecution and the defence presented them as lesbians. The press saw that as totally sensational. The defence used the lesbianism as they said it was they were mad and suffering from paranoia of the exalted type and folie à deux, whatever that is. These things were completely discredited by the Crown psychiatrists at the time. But they said lesbianism was a symptom of this mental disease. So that was presented in that way. And the prosecution said they were bad, they were dirty-minded little girls, and they'd done this crime because they were lesbians and wanted to be together, so therefore it was a motive for the crime. And it also showed what bad little girls they were because they were lesbians. And, of course, that was very bad. It gave lesbianism a very sensational, quasi-criminal, psychopathic presentation. And although lesbianism wasn't a criminal offence in 1954, any sex between men was a criminal offence. There were long, lengthy jail sentence and that sort of thing. And in fact, many people thought, why should lesbians get away with it? Lesbianism ought to be criminalised.
Here we come to the scene of the murder. I said before that it was getting wet and slushy underfoot, but one can imagine Pauline's mother, Honora, starting to complain and grumble a bit. What on earth are we doing walking all the way down here? You can see we're in the middle of nowhere. And apparently it came to a point where she said she wasn't going to go any further. And the two girls walked on a bit further, without her, without the mother, and I would assume that was to have a last-minute conference. And then they walked back up, and they caught up with Pauline's mother. And at this point, Pauline was walking behind her mother, Juliet was walking ahead, and then Juliet actually rushed a little way ahead so she could drop the coloured stone on the path. And you can work out the scene, because it was just past this little wooden bridge or culvert that we're walking over now. Honora did bend down to look at the little stone that Juliet had dropped on the path, and Pauline drew from her shoulder bag the half brick and the stocking, and she swung it at her mother's head as hard as she could. But her mother didn't obligingly fall down dead. She must have let out some terrible screams, and she put up a fight. And she put, we could see from some of the injuries, just for example, the little finger of one hand was almost severed, just hanging on by a little piece of skin, so it shows she was trying to protect her head, holding up her hands, trying to protect her head. In the end, they forced Mrs. Parker to the ground, and her head was held against the ground by the neck, and eventually the stocking broke, and the girls were just clubbing her on the head wherever they could land a blow.
Hi there, you Eric?
That's me.
Hi Laura, I'm Ruth Barron. Nice to meet you. Someone you might remember.
Yeah, Wally Coppell, how are you?
Yeah, good, bloody.
Wondering if we can come in and ask you some questions. Eric, as I understand it, you were a police officer at the time when this murder happened in Christchurch. Did you actually go to the murder scene?
Yes.
What did you see?
Well, it was a bit of a mess, really.
Wasn't something you'd normally see?
No. Not yet what you'd expect to see.
In what way?
The injuries were such that it was obvious that it was a savage murder.
Kenneth Ritchie and Eric McElroy had run a quarter of a mile down the rough track when they came upon a woman lying on her back near a ramshackle bridge of wooden planks. Her legs, splayed indecently, lay toward them. Her head, smashed and bloody, was downhill. The woman's eyes were closed and bulging. Her mouth gaped and her hair was matted with globs of blood. Blood smeared her face and was caked in her mouth and nostrils. Jets of blood from her head had travelled in rivulets, now clotted 12 feet down the track. Her skirt was around her thighs. Instinctively protecting the woman's modesty, Kenneth Ritchie pulled at the hem to cover her knees. It didn't look like an accident, he thought. There were no rocks anywhere near, and on the ground, a foot from her head, there was a half brick with blood and bits of hair on it. And from here, the two girls raced up the hill back to the kiosk, and they were yelling and screaming that, there'd been a terrible something, help, 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 there's been a terrible accident, my mother's had this terrible accident, she may be dead, and so on. Juliet chiming in, and I think they were in shock, probably, to some extent.
I'm standing in the lush gardens of Islam Homestead, looking at the house where the Hume family lived in 1954. I can't get into the building because it's ringed with fences and cracked because of the recent earthquakes. But it happens to be the only building left standing in Christchurch that actually relates to this case.
By day, they used to play, they would dress up and they would perform little plays together. They would play really like, I think you might expect much younger children to be playing, and Pauline was usually in a subordinate role to Juliet. She was the attendant or the maid-in-waiting or something like that, and Juliet had a horse, and sometimes at night they would saddle up Juliet's horse and go for midnight gallops.
It was used as a cautionary tale. Girls and women out of control. So right throughout the case, what we see are girls and women out of control, and there was terrible consequences. So firstly, we have Honora Parker, and she's living with a man she's not married to, so that's a woman out of control. Then we have Hilda Hume, and she's taken a lover, so that's a woman out of control. And then we have these two girls, and they're having sex together, maybe. At any rate, they're out quite a lot at night, and they're out of control. So this is what happens when women and girls are out of control. Then terrifying events happen. So the message is, it's a cautionary tale. Let's keep women and girls well under control so that people don't break the rules and do this kind of thing. And other things happen too, like in schools, the teachers became watchful about friendships between girls, wanting to separate girls before they became too close, because we all know where lesbianism leads. So in that sense, it has very negative consequences.
By the time the police arrived, the two girls had gone, because they'd also phoned Henry Hume. Henry Hume drove up in his Jaguar, and the two girls were popped into the back seat, and they were off before the police arrived. Henry Hume left his address for the... I mean, he wasn't trying to run away from the scene, but nonetheless, he was probably quite relieved to have got away before the police arrived.
Well, when we pulled into the drive, my vivid memory of the light shining out of this window upstairs, and the music coming out, which wasn't sort of in keeping with what you'd expect from two people that had just committed a savage murder.
What sort of music was it?
Well, it was modern music in those days.
So not really sort of soothing music?
No.
And what were the girls like? Did you see them?
Yes. They appeared quite happy.
Happy?
Yeah.
Which again probably wasn't what you were expecting, really.
No.
I think at the time one of the things that the public couldn't understand is the lack of remorse.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes, they absolutely gloated in their success. They thought they'd been tremendously clever. And in carrying off this murder, they crowed about it. It was something that was quite horrifying. And even one of the psychiatrists, Dr. Medlicott, said when he spoke to those girls, he felt that he was in the presence of evil.
The police station used to run right along, just along here, not right to the corner, and it was only two stories, and they used to have had a stone fence with wrought iron and just had two entrances virtually.
And where were the cells?
The cells were just over in the middle of the yard there.
Right. And did you spend many nights looking after prisoners?
Yes, I was the watch housekeeper sometimes. And we used to have to look after, put the prisoners in there.
And in 1954 you had a couple of very interesting prisoners.
Yes, Parky Hume girls. Being charged with murder and unconvicted, they had to be looked after 24 hours a day.
In case of what?
In case they tried to commit suicide or harm themselves.
Do you think that was likely?
No, I do not, no.
Why not?
Well, because just the way they carried on like two normal people.
In what way?
Well, they just chatted away as though nothing had happened. They come and asked me for a cup of tea and I told them to go back to bed, and after a quarter of an hour that we never heard any more from them.
And do you think that sort of behaviour was usual in that case?
Well, they didn't seem to be very concerned about anything.
And what was their relationship like?
Well, they seemed quite friendly, actually. You wouldn't have known that that anything had gone on at all. They never talked about it or, you know, didn't discuss the case or anything.
I can't help thinking when I come down here of that terrible moment for Mrs. Parker when she realised that she had been inveigled to come to this lonely spot so that her daughter and her daughter's friend could kill her. She certainly would have realised that before she died. See, it's quite a good place, isn't it, for a murder? Because A, you know, you're miles from anywhere. And if someone was walking down, you could see them coming, couldn't you?
Yes. I mean, I knew at the time I would have given anything, if there were any way, I could have felt that I could have got out of it without her dying. But that sounds so silly now, but that's
15.
How I felt at the time, yes. And, yes, within a couple of months, I had 3 months solitary confinement straight away. This was a decision made before I ever got there, to the prison. And during that time, I did a great deal of self-examination, I had a lot of nightmares, and finally I'd been in a state of terror. I got out of bed and I got on my knees in the dark and I said, I am sorry. This was wrong. I am at fault and I am sorry. And from then on, it began to heal. And that's 40 years ago. And it has healed.
And if this case happened today, what do you think the outcome would have been?
I think if this case happened today, firstly, they would have name suppression. I think they would be treated very, very differently. It would not be permitted in 2012 that you could have a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old treated as if they were mature adults and able to be named in newspapers and turned into a sensation and have their lives, you know, damaged in that way. Part of why this murder was seen as sensational at the time is that girls and women are supposed to be the victims of crimes rather than the perpetrators of them. So it's always seen as much worse when a girl or a woman commits a crime and is the perpetrator rather than the victim. So that's seen as, that's part of the theme of women and girls out of control. But I think in terms of the modern world, we've seen so many more domestic crimes. And this is, we must never forget the fact that this is a domestic murder. Most murders are domestic murders, and they happen because of stresses in the relationship between the killer and the victim.
How long did they end up in prison for?
Roughly 5.5 years. They were 21 when they were released, which is not very long by today's standards. If you committed the same sort of murder today with even young people with premeditation, you'd be looking at 10 or 15 years minimum non-parole period. When they were released from prison, they were given new identities by the New Zealand government. Pauline became Hilary Nathan, and Juliet was called Anne Stewart when she left New Zealand, but she later changed her name to Anne Stewart Perry And then when she became a published writer of detective fiction, she called herself Anne Perry. And so Anne Perry she is today.
How's the village been?
Marvellous.
They've coped, have they?
They've more than coped. Nobody refers to it, but people say, how are you, dear? You all right? And when it first broke, the first person we told was the postmistress, who's a wonderful lady. And then we had to spend the rest of that day, I had to pick up the telephone and call all the people I know have to do with in business. You know, my publisher, editors, publicist assistant. Mm. That was one of the worst things to have to tell them this and say...
The most extraordinary thing to have to ring up someone and say there's just something about my past you ought to know.
Yes, yeah. And it's going to blow all over the place day after tomorrow. But the village sent, you know, sympathy cards. I don't mean sort of bereavement sympathy, but just nice cards. Somebody left homemade shortbread on my mother's doorstep. Flowers. I mean, this is the kind of village it is. Nobody has referred to it since. I go into the nearest town. That was one of the nightmare things, because we've always had very good relationships with... the bank, the chemist, all this sort of thing. And they're delightful people. And to go in and wait for their faces to change. But nobody did. Nobody.
Mm.
But, you know, it was terrible to walk in and wait to meet their eyes and how is it going to be? Mm. But everybody has been just that little bit kinder.
Are you going to pull the curtain back down? You've talked to a newspaper that you chose and you took responsibility for the interview. You've come down here to talk to us now. Will there be a stage at which you sort of say, that's it, said what I'm going to say, it's on the record, forget it?
Depending upon what the question is, I mean, I'm a writer. If it's about my books, I hope people will go on being interested. If it's about my personal life, the only thing that I think really could be of value is if other people have fallen flat in their faces at any point and feel it's hopeless... There's always hope. You can get up, not only have an adequate life, you can have a very good life. It's never too late. And never give up on anybody else either.
Mm.
And that is something that's worth saying, and I would be prepared to go on saying that as long as anybody wants to listen.
Anne Perry, having the last word in that piece, reflecting on her role in one of New Zealand's most famous murder cases. You also heard the voices of Ruth Barron, Peter Graham, the author of Parker, Hume and the Crime That Shocked the World, Dr. Alison Laurie, and police officers Eric McLaughlin and Wally Colville. The diary excerpt was read by Clarissa Dunn. Mrs. Parker was produced by Ruth Barron and Gareth Watkins for Radio New Zealand as part of the Global Perspectives Program Exchange.